Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Walter Hang. Hang is a longtime environmental activist and founder and president of Toxics Targeting, an environmental data firm located in Ithaca, New York. In addition to working with engineers, consultants, developers, and government agencies, Toxics Targeting also works with property buyers, checking homes and businesses for potential environmental hazards. Under his continuing leadership, Toxics Targeting currently manages data for more than 540,000 known and potential toxic sites in New York State and has been instrumental in driving many local cleanups in the Finger Lakes area, including the cleanup work involving Cayuga Lake. Welcome to the show, Walter.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, I want to start with your beginnings. Before you turned your sights on environmental concerns, I understand that you were working with cancer patients, and that led you directly into environmental work.
Well, when I was a student, I thought I was going to cure cancer. And so I got an internship one summer at a place called Roswell Park in Buffalo. Mm. And that was a really renowned cancer research and treatment facility. And I went there, and I started basically killing little kids with chemotherapy. And I suddenly realized I had made like a tragic error in, you know, planning for my future. And so I asked my boss, I said, Bob, what does our work really have to do with curing cancer? And he said, about as much as the Indianapolis 500. And I got so depressed. It was seminar day, so I went to hide in the library, and I saw this paper. And it was the map that showed cancer mortality rates nationwide, county by county. And this map clearly showed that states like New York and states around the Great Lakes had the highest cancer mortality rates. And I looked at it and I said, it has to be something in the environment, because all the big cities had the highest cancer mortality rates, places like Buffalo, Syracuse, Niagara Falls.
That's unbelievable. What year was this when you started this?
1975.
Long time ago.
And so I thought, you know, if it's something in the environment and we don't expose ourselves to it, then we won't get cancer, and then we won't have to treat it or cure it, neither of which we can do anyway. And that little revelatory moment has basically decided my fate.
Uh-huh. And that's when you decided that's how you could actually really prevent cancer.
Well, I got hired by New York Public Interest Research Group, and they were doing a study of the Hudson River. And I was from a town on the Hudson called Stattsburg, New York, and I knew that people drank water from the river. And so I said, this isn't only a river study, it's really a health study, because I knew that there were studies that showed consumption of cancer-causing agents in drinking water was associated with elevated cancer mortality rates of the gastrointestinal and urinary tract. And so we wrote this huge study. We showed that pollutants were dumped in the river. We showed that people were drinking it, but we didn't understand. It wasn't really a technical problem. It wasn't a legal problem. It was illegal. And there were ways to solve the problem. It was really a political problem. And that's when we began to try to lobby, basically the legislature to change the law and enforce the law. And we went to make a presentation, and the senior official said, frankly, we don't like any of those ideas, after we showed him our data. Then he kicked us out.
Really?
And we were on the third floor of the Capitol, and I looked at my colleague and I said, I think this means all of our bills are dead in the Senate. And it was the second day of session, so we realized it was a lot more complicated than we originally thought.
Yeah, you must have realized quite quickly that you were going up against big business vis-a-vis politicians, right?
Well, we were so young at the time. Uh-huh. We really had no idea. We thought there was such a thing as scientific truth. We thought that if we proved that the law was not being enforced, if we showed that these compounds were present in the wastewater, that it was winding up in drinking water, you know, we thought that there would be no dispute that something had to be done. We were completely ignorant of the political ramifications, but that's what we learned over the next 12 years.
Uh-huh. And what kind of toxins and pollutants were you finding in that?
We were finding all kinds of chemical solvents like trichloroethylene, like benzene, toluene, xylene, polychlorinated biphenyls, heavy metals, you name it.
And where were they coming from? Did you guys surmise where they might have been coming from?
Sure. We would look literally industry by industry. We would look at municipal wastewater treatment plants that had industries online. And we would say, well, what is in the wastewater of this particular type of manufacturing operation, which had what's called the Standard Industrial Classification Code? Then we'd look at the monitoring. We'd show that the compounds were there. Then we looked at the discharge permits, and we say there are no effluent limitations. And that's how come the contaminants were not being adequately controlled.
Ah, It's unbelievable that people think they can throw things into water that people drink and there aren't going to be any consequences.
Well, it is so true. I mean, decades ago, there was a great deal of energy and money dedicated to protecting fishable, swimmable water. Mm. But basically, that money ran out and the problems were never solved. That's how I got interested in lake source cooling, because I had looked at literally thousands of wastewater discharge permits and I knew that they were not very stringent. And so when I looked at lake source cooling, it wasn't involved with toxic chemicals, but it was involved with phosphorus. And I knew that that would fertilize weeds and algae that were already rampant in the area of Cuga Lake where the discharge was going into the lake. Mm-hmm. So this was a classic case of, again, the law not being enforced. And this time I tried to work with Natural Resources Defense Council, a national group. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's a discussion about how if you want to dump pollution into an area of a lake or a river or a stream that already has too much, you can do that, but you have to offset the discharge by cleaning up other sources in the watershed.
Oh.
So I hired a young scientist. He walked 100 miles of the tributaries, and he mapped, including my company's data, about 1,000 pollution sources. And so people started to rat out their neighbors when I put that information on the internet. And that's how in Little Ithaca, New York, we've now driven about 85 million in toxic cleanup. We're still slugging it out on Lake Source Cooling
and Cuga
Lake.
We will definitely talk about that. Let's talk about what did prompt you finally to start your company. Toxics targeting, it's a wonderful resource for people. How did you begin that?
Well, I realized that one of the most important things that is needed to drive improvement of the environment, protection of drinking water and protecting public health is awareness. And so by the end of my 12 years at NYPIRG, I was spending maybe 20% of my time being a researcher, spending about 80% of my time alerting communities to the problems in their midst, getting press coverage and the like. This is almost exactly the reversal of when I started out. So I'd be on TV, and then people would call me up and they'd say, hey, I saw you near that Hooker Chemical site, and I was wondering, is my drinking water polluted? By the way, I'm closing on Tuesday. And so I'd be like looking at maps and looking at the data and trying to figure out how much pollution there was and which way it was going in the groundwater. And one day I thought to myself, you know, there has to be a way to do this with computers. And so I knew someone who was associated with one of the wealthiest families in America, and I got venture capital funding to start my company. But I had no idea how hard it was going to be to get the data and to map the data so that you could retrieve the information to know, for example, how many leaking tanks and spills and toxic dumps are within half a mile of a particular location. Mm-hmm. And that's what our company does. We compile those government data.
And how much do you trust the government data? I mean, do you think that your sources are reliable? Do you have people who can actually go out and double check?
Well, the government data are very, very reliable with one exception, and that is the address information. So I know your listeners will be shocked, but when polluters report a leaking tank or a toxic dump, they don't provide good address information because, in effect, they don't want to get inspected. They don't want to get fined. They don't want to run afoul of the government agencies. So they say it's on West Court Street or Route 9 or Route 5. And so we have to figure out where these sites are. And we drive around, we call, we cross-reference. But once we've figured out where these 540,000 sites are in New York, we can retrieve those data very quickly. And then people can read the information themselves. Does this problem meet the standards? Is drinking water affected? Is the lake affected? Like, what's going on? So we're like little cyber clerks at Toxics Targeting. We just give people the data that they really can't get on their own because it's so hard to use the Freedom of Information laws.
And it takes so long, too.
Federal,
yeah, yeah. You have mentioned that there are more than 540,000 known or potential hazardous sites in New York State. It sounds like the whole state's a dump.
Well,
I mean, where are all these?
They're hither and yon. They're not just dumps. They're also leaking tanks and spills and pollution discharges and hazardous waste generators. And it's pretty much anthropomorphic, which means where there are people, that's where you have a lot of these sites. So if you go to a place like Rochester, there are going to be a lot more. If you go to a place like Buffalo, which is one of the most industrialized cities in the country, it's just inundated. But if you go to the middle of nowhere in the Adirondack Mountains, there are very, very few sites. Mm-hmm. And so Ithaca is kind of in between. We don't have a lot of industry, but we do have some very, very problematic sites. And generally speaking, the vast majority of properties, even in places like Buffalo or Brooklyn or New York City, they're not impacted. But it's all luck of the draw. You could be on top of or adjoining a highly problematic site and never know it. And people don't check when they buy homes, when they rent an apartment. They have no idea these sites are there. No one tells them.
That's remarkable. What do you mean by potential? I mean, you use the word potential in your...
A classic potential problem is like a tank that's holding gasoline. You put the tank in the ground, and if it's a single wall steel tank that they use traditionally, the day it goes in, it begins to rust. And after about 25 years, you can have a tiny little crack or a tiny little hole that's just caused by corrosion, but it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the next thing you know, you can have 2.5 feet of gasoline. Now that's an actual problem. So it went from being a potential problem that ultimately developed into a real hazard. And you'd be just blown away by how many sites, even here in Ithaca, where there's 3 feet of oil in the ground.
Oh. That's just remarkable. So if people look on your map and they see that they might have pollutants or potential problems right around their own housing, who would they call?
Well, the first thing is they can go and check out a free map of about 270,000 sites across New York at toxicstargeting.com. And just click on the free toxic site map. And this is called an internet map server. So it's really great. You look at the toxic site map, but you can also then cross-reference with Google, Street View, and Bird's Eye View, so you can see what's around you. So if you see that there's a site, number one, you can buy a report from us, and you can then get the data. So the free maps tell you, is there something around me or not? If you don't see anything, then if you're buying a home, you maybe want to buy a report anyway, because there are always sites that have very, very obscure references. But if you read the data, you might be concerned, like hit buried tank while digging cesspool. Mm. Now you know you got to be concerned.
Where do people go if they do find toxins? I mean, you guys don't take care of that kind of stuff.
Well,
EPA?
We can walk people through the data and make sure they understand what's going on. We're not consultants. We don't tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then we say, aha, this data set was generated by the Department of Environmental Conservation. Here's the DEC spill investigator. Here's his phone number or her phone number. Call up and then you can ask questions. And we basically walk them through the data. And that way they can figure out, is this a problem? Is this not a problem? Has this been cleaned up? Is it going to be cleaned up? Like, what's happening?
Mm-hmm. What a great service, Walter. Really amazing. Now, I want to ask you this too. Has the war on terror and the creation of Homeland Security made it any more difficult to find access to some of this data?
Absolutely. A lot of the tank data for petroleum bulk storage, chemical bulk storage, a lot of that information is now withheld. So our reports are now a combination of current data and archival information. And it's very hard to know now where drinking water supply wells are. If you submit a request, you can't get that information. Fortunately, we already had it. So Homeland Security has had a really profound impact on the public's access to this information that's really essential for safeguarding their health as well as their property value. It's a really ongoing debate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Hang. He's an environmental activist, and he's president and founder of Toxics Targeting. On that same line of Homeland Security and it perhaps stopping people from getting information, do you think it'll get any better under the Obama administration?
You never know. I mean, he might be a little bit more open-minded, but what people don't know is that the Environmental Protection Agency is just a shell of its former self. Mm. Just like the Department of Environmental Conservation was just brutally cut to the bone under the Pataki administration, under the Bush administration, EPA really doesn't have the wherewithal to regulate discharges, clean sites up. It's just shocking. When you go to the EPA, and I just met with Lisa Jackson, Jackson, the head of the EPA in Washington, you know, they just are crying poverty. They just don't have the staff, the engineers, the attorneys. You know, so really people need to be aware that if they want the Obama administration to be more open about government access to records, they have to call for that. If they want to clean up pollution, they've got to make their point. Obama is basically like all elected officials. He's a political barometer. There's more pressure on him to do things to protect the environment than that is probably what he's going to do. But if people don't push, then he'll talk about global warming.
Indeed. Now, you've been in the business of identifying toxins and pollutants for many, many years now. Do you feel that we've made any headway? Do people care more?
Number one, we have made enormous headway. I mean, we have cleaned up water pollution on a scale that's really impressive. The problem is that the environmental movement is really non-existent on many levels. There's a global warming movement, and then there's nothing else. So when I talk to students, they have no idea what a toxic dump is. They never heard of the Love Canal, where people got evacuated from around a hazardous waste site. And so there really isn't any pressure anymore to, you know, provide the driving force to actually clean up contamination. Meanwhile, my company is identifying 4,000 leaking tanks and spills every quarter. So the legacy of pollution problems that we are struggling to come to grips with is getting bigger and bigger and bigger because we dump so much pollution in decades gone by, and it's finally spread all the way to make it into a river or a lake, or it's finally impacted indoor air in a home or a school. This is exactly what we found in Ithaca, but there's not enough driving force to actually clean up the pollution. And what we've showed in Ithaca is that if you know the law, if you know the secret handshake, we've driven $85 million worth of cleanup by responsible parties pretty much. So we're probably the most successful cleanup effort anywhere in the country, but that's because so little cleanup is going on from coast to coast. It's really appalling.
I think I've identified the new leader of the environmental movement sitting here in front of me who can maybe start it up again. What do you point to the demise of the environmental movement? After Earth Day, people thought we'd already done our thing, or what?
Number one, I think a lot of the really big national environmental groups, you know, bless them all, they didn't really want to get into
Sierra
fights.
Club and well, groups like that.
You know, basically a lot of the research and advocacy entities, Environmental Defense, Natural Resources Defense Council, they have tens of millions of dollars. But what they did was they said, we're going to recommend policies, and then that's all we're going to do. And anyone that's involved in environmental matters knows this is a fight. This is political activism at the grassroots level. And you have to be willing to shed the political blood if you want to get things done. Mm-hmm. And that's what they really got away from. So before Earth Day, it was all of us young students, you know, jumping up and down, yelling, waving signs, getting in the press. And that's how the environmental movement was born. And then there was people like, I just saw a great picture of Bob Boyle, who basically revealed the PCB pollution in the Hudson River. And he is just a rough character who cares so much about the environment. He wrote a great book, The Natural and Unnatural History of the Hudson River. He was a famous Sports Illustrated writer. He really publicized and he pushed. And then so the Hudson got better. But those days are really long gone. And so we need to revitalize the environmental movement by basically showing people an effective model of how you can get problems cleaned up. And that's what I love to do, is I help drinking water purveyors on Long Island. I help municipalities. And I work with people like Chuck Schumer. In 2003, we killed a $31 billion energy bill that would have transferred cleanup liability for a gasoline additive called MTBE, maybe $30 to $100 billion worth of cleanup. It really impacts drinking water. So Tom DeLay wanted to shift the liability to ratepayers for drinking water and taxpayers.
Oh,
he wanted to shield the oil companies from all liability. So we killed a $31 billion bill based on a one-paragraph provision. Chuck filibustered it, They got 58 votes. They needed 60, and we harpooned that bill. They came back in 2005. We killed it again, and we got that provision removed. So if people know the secret handshake, they can be amazingly effective.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where my reports come in, because it can identify problems so people can see, hey, that threatens my kid's school, or that threatens my drinking water, or that mm-hmm. threatens the lake I love so much. And then we work with them to try to get these problems cleaned up.
You are living proof that one person can make a huge difference. Now, before we run out of time, let's talk about Cuga Lake and lake source cooling. Where are we on that here in our Finger Lakes region?
We're in an 11-year fight about an illegal discharge that is contributing phosphorus to an area of the lake that already had way too much phosphorus. That's why it's inundated with algae and weeds. So under the Pataki administration, we really couldn't get anywhere. And then Elliot Spitzer came along and appointed Pete Granis to be the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner, and he's just terrific.
Mm.
So he's really helping. We forced Cornell to do a before and after control impact study that showed that the most impacted area of the lake has had a statistically significant increase in what's called chlorophyll A, which measures algae. So there's 50% more algae in that most heavily impacted area of the lake compared to when lake source cooling first went online. And so I've met with the head of the EPA in Washington. I just met with the regional EPA people. I went with Rich DiPaolo, who's a Town of Ithaca
Indeed.
Board member.
Mm-hmm.
And we really think that lake source cooling is either going to have to move its discharge pipe to deep water to send the phosphorus down to the bottom of the lake again, or they're going to have to treat it to take out the phosphorus. And we think we're going to basically get the authorities to try to remove all the sediment that's flowing into the lake from the impaired tributaries, and that also has phosphorus attached to the silt and the sediment.
Mm.
So we think we're going to maybe be able to get the lake cleaned up, but it's going to be a huge challenge. It's just inundated
yeah.
with algae and weeds in the summertime, basically.
Yeah, this is going to be an ongoing thing that you'll be working on for years. Is one of the next things that you may be tackling, what about the gas drilling issue that seems to be in the forefront now? Where are you on that?
Well, I have the data for all of the gas and oil wells, and I might look into it. It's a pretty formidable undertaking. I mean, when I first started on lake source cooling, we were just focused on the lake. And now we're focused on cleaning up Ithaca Gun. We're in the final stages of that. We're focused on West Court Street, which is a huge coal tar remediation site in Ithaca. It's this giant sprung structure. They're moving it around. They're digging out all this coal tar. We're working on Morse Chain. So we really need a lot of volunteers, but a lot of people have asked me about the drilling. And as you can imagine, there really isn't anything more polluting than really mining.
Oh, yeah.
And so we just happen to be smack dab in the middle of this Marcellus formation. And it's interesting because I learned about natural gas because I coach youth hockey.
Mm.
And years and years ago, these kids would start to show up and they'd say, oh, I'm from Calgary, but I haven't skated for 5 years because my family's been living in Jakarta, Indonesia. And I'd say, what were you doing there? And they'd say, oh, my dad works for a natural gas company.
Ah.
And they were all coming to Ithaca, wave after wave of them. And that's how I figured out what was going on. So this is going to be a biggie, and we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in regard to the free map that you have for people to try to spot pollutants and potential problems in or around their properties or businesses, do you do follow-up when there is cleanup and take them off that map? How do you deal with that?
We never take sites off. Once the site is in our database, once it's in the local, state, or federal databases, they're always in there. But if a cleanup has been conducted, then that is described. But the key thing is a lot of cleanups are highly incomplete.
Mm.
So there's a key data field that you can't get from the Department of Environmental Conservation website, and it's meet standards. So a lot of times they do an incomplete cleanup, and it still doesn't meet the standards. And because the pollution is underground, you can't see it. That's how come it's so important to get the information and then talk to the engineer who was involved in the remedial effort. And then you can find out, was it done properly or not? Like in Morse Chain in 1994, they said, we've adopted a record of decision, and the site's going to get cleaned up in 3 years or less. I came along 10 years later. The trichloroethylene was supposed to only be present at 5 parts per billion, and the data showed it was 28,000 parts per billion.
My gosh.
And the consultant for Emerson Power Transmission, which had bought Morse Chain, the consultant said there's no clear declining trend. And so it went from saying, yeah, it's all cleaned up, continued maintenance required, now it's a significant threat to the public health or environment, action is required. That's how come you have to be very careful about monitoring these sites.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the hang up for cleaning up these sites? So you'd think businesses wouldn't want to get bad publicity. Is it usually just monetary and financial, or just reluctance to have the knowledge out there?
I think, number one, it's just the brutal cost. I mean, a lot of the remedial efforts that were conducted years and years ago were very limited. Like, they tried to pump out all the polluted groundwater, and that just really didn't work. And so when you do a rigorous cleanup, you have to dig all the pollution out. That's called source removal.
Uh-huh.
That's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly disruptive. Like at West Court Street, they're digging down to 15 feet below grade, but they drove sheet pile 54 feet below grade to try to contain the pollution. So you can imagine the cost of that. Second thing is that the companies don't want to get a black eye. They don't really want to reveal that, hey, there's 1 to 2 feet of coal tar at this site, and that it's migrating into a residential neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the likelihood that they're going to get caught is very, very low, because they've successfully dismantled a lot of the regulatory agencies. So when you go to US EPA, there are almost no people there. It's like entering a mausoleum. It is. And if, unless people get more aware and more active, we're never going to have the financial commitment to rebuilding and reinvigorating these agencies. And that's how come when I met with Lisa Jackson, Ralph Nader invited me to attend the meeting he set up. She said she wanted to improve regulatory enforcement and she wanted to reinvigorate the agency. And we're going to help her because we're going to identify a lot of problems that have never been cleaned up. And it's going to make the public's hair stand on end. And then the squeaky wheel is going to get the grease.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully there will be more funding. But the key thing is that the rule of the land is that the polluters have to pay. But if you don't have the attorney generals taking action, if you don't have individual attorneys taking action, then there's really a lack of enforcement. And that's what we've really proved here in Ithaca, that if you have regulatory authorities that are focused on pollution problems, like Southern Cayuga Lake, like these toxic sites that we've identified, and if you know how to read the data and get press coverage and alert the public, and then find all these citizen activists that say, Fall Creek is a lovely place to live and it's worth fighting for.
Mm.
I mean, Lisa Sanfilippo, this woman I met, said that and it brought tears to my eyes. So that's the most wonderful thing that I have encountered, is I've met all these great people like Rich DiPaolo and Lisa Sanfilippo and Charlie Izzo, her husband, and they fought and they fought and they fought, and they've been unrelenting in the public interest, and that's really, really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
People really owe these people a debt of gratitude.
Well, I think we owe you a debt of gratitude too, Walter Hing. We are almost out of time. Give your contact information one more time.
It's toxicstargeting.com, and you can email me, walter@toxicstargeting.com. But check out the free maps, see what's in your neighborhood. And for all the people who have contacted me anonymously with little tips about pollution problems, including the other day where mercury was reported at Cornell,
oh, yeah.
Keep calling me, keep giving me a heads up, and we'll do our best to see if we can get these problems cleaned up.
Well, Walter Hing, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with all your activism. You do us a great service here.
Thank you. You're too kind.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.